detail about the different sacrifices and the symbolic significance of them and all that. But we did want to see the underlying legal principles, and we observed that under the law, that the greater the responsibility of a person, the greater the sin in violating the law of God. We observed the legal principle that ignorance was no excuse for the violation of the law. And we're down on page 52 to the third principle, that restitution must precede cleansing. There can be no cleansing without restitution. As a matter of fact, when you study the law, you discover that whenever you have defrauded someone or defrauded God, you're required to pay a penalty. The penalty is equal to 20%, a double tithe of the amount that you defrauded. That is, you return what you defrauded plus that much penalty. Additional, is what I'm trying to say. And that doesn't matter whether you stole something or defrauded a person or whether you defrauded God, the same principle applies. So the idea is that you cannot profit from sin. The wages of sin, you're not to enrich yourself by means of sin. Now today, unfortunately, so many times a person goes to jail and yet he still has in his bank account all the money that he earned through theft or through fraud or deceit or whatever it might be. Take the case of the Ivan Mosky case just within the last few weeks. And I guess he's been given a pretty stiff sentence in one respect, and yet in another respect, the guy has millions of dollars he got through fraud in Swiss bank accounts, apparently, that he will come out of his sentence in a few short months and still live high on the hog due to the crimes that he committed on the stock market. Well, under the law of God, that would not be possible, because you have to return that which was wrongfully taken. Now, what we're trying to relate to the second commandment is the fact that worship must be at the right spot and with the right materials and through the right mediation. That's the priesthood, and I'm not going to take time in this class to develop that, although I've given you some material in the appendix on that subject. But let's talk about what else is required for the right kind of worship under the law was holiness. The right kind of consecration. The people of God were to be a holy people. Be ye holy, for I am holy, God says. There is a concern in the law for national as well as personal holiness. And there's a New Testament emphasis upon the fact that the church collectively is to be holy, as well as we individual Christians. God's laws are enforced and true faith is protected when there will be a holy nation if that happens. Now, the principle involved in holiness basically is separation. Holiness means separate from the world, as we saw last week. If you have the law, there is inescapably a line of separation between those that obey the law and those that deny the law and disobey the law. Conversely, where there is no law, there is no separation, hence there can be no holiness. Now, today in the church, people talk about personal holiness. But if you really try to pin them down, what is that? It's different for different people, apparently. There's no clear-cut demarcation between the Christian and the person of the world, because there is no concept of divine standards. You do what you think is right, I do what I think is right, and there is no objective standard for measuring right and wrong in the eyes even of many Christians, unfortunately. Consequently, there can be no true holiness without a law to identify what that line of separation between the believer and the world is. Every biblical law, ultimately, at its root, is concerned with holiness, of drawing the line between the believer and the world. some laws set forth the principle of holiness or separation in a symbolic form, in rituals, in ceremonies, and others set it forth in a literal way. In our lifestyles, we are to be separate from the world. Now let's consider, for the next few moments then, some of the ritual ways in which holiness is depicted. Remember, the essence of holiness is separation. So, in certain ritual ways, the Israelites' separation from the world was depicted. They were to be separated from everything that was contrary to God. Death is the opposite of life. Death is the enemy. Death is against God. And therefore, the believer of the Old Testament was to be separated from death. God is not the God of the dead, He is the God of the living, we are told. Ultimately, the people who were believers in God of the Old Testament time, and even us today, will be totally separated, eternally separated from death. You understand that? We are in the process of dying now. Death is a very real part of our world. But there will come a time when we will be forever separated from death. That is God's goal. That is where God is headed with things. And so the Israelites were to regard death as something from which they were to be separated. Do you see how by being separated from death in this life, they were bearing testimony to that ultimate separation from death in eternity? It's like the ritual observance or the emblems of the Lord's Supper. Is our testimony to the world that we believe in the death, the burial, and the crucifixion, the resurrection of Jesus. A cup and the bread remind us of that. So for the Old Testament Israelite, the separation from death testified to his confidence and faith that someday he would eternally be separated from death. So, after they came in contact with a dead body, of course, burial is inevitable. You have to bury dead people. Some people would have to come in contact with death, or if a member of your family was found dead in the home, there obviously would be contact with death. But the law required that there would be purification after death. Death contaminates. Death is the enemy. When you're in the presence of death, you're in the presence of the enemy. Therefore, before you can come back into the fellowship of God, there must be purification. So God was teaching some important, eternal, theological principles by enforcing this idea of separate from death. Secondly, and along the same lines, God's people were to be separate from disease. That's why, under the law of Moses, there were provisions for quarantine of those with contagious diseases. They were compelled to live outside the camp, outside of society. For God's people were a holy people. They were to be separate from death and everything associated with death or everything that leads to death. Now, God's people are destined for health as well as life. Disease and death are abnormal. Not what God intended. And therefore, God's people, to demonstrate their holiness, were to be separate from both. They were to be cut off from diseases symbolically through ritual. And so whenever someone had a contagious disease, which is described under the generic term leprosy, before he could be readmitted to the fellowship of the congregation, he had to be inspected by a priest. He had to shave himself and go through ritual purification, offer some offerings before he would be allowed to be reunited with the congregation. God was reinforcing the idea that disease is that which is contrary. That's the enemy. God's people are to be separate from the enemy. All right. And then there was to be separation from ceremonial and physical uncleanness. Uncleanness is associated with I think the idea of sin and even physical uncleanness was associated with that idea. So, you'll see the list of things there that could make a person unclean. And from all of those matters under the law, there would have to be a cleansing, a purification. Some of these items in paganism were viewed as manifestations of holiness. But God says, no, if it defiles you, if it makes you unclean physically, it disqualifies you from entering into the worship, to the congregation of my people. My people are to be clean, and the outward cleanliness is to be but a symbol of the inward cleanliness. It is to be separation from the world, holiness in all aspects of your life. And you will notice by looking over the list, some have been critical of the list because they believe that this is an affront to women. But you will notice by looking over the list that the principle is that whenever there were emissions of body fluids from the genital organs, it disqualified a person from participating in worship until they had been purified, until they had been cleansed, whether male or female. Didn't make any difference. So, again, the idea of holiness, separation. Separation from that which defiles physically. Separation from that which destroys the body. Separation from death. Separation from uncleanness. Now, the practice of holiness, particularly as it manifested itself in their eating habits, this was probably the most visible and obvious way in which people could identify the Israelites as God's distinct and unique people. Apparently, as I read the law, all vegetables were legitimate. They could be eaten. Blood was always unlawful. 17 different passages tell us that they're not to eat blood. What does that mean, to eat blood, Missy? Why such laws? Why 17 laws forbidding the eating of blood? Do you make laws to condemn practices which are non-existent? Do you think that there ever will be a day, or can you conceive right now in our society of the legislature meeting for an emergency session in Tallahassee to outlaw driving four-wheel vehicles up telephone poles? No, it's not a real problem in our society at the present time. There could be a day when we'll have automobiles that will drive up telephone poles, and when that happens, I suppose they'll meet and make a law about it. But right now, it's not a problem. You don't make laws to deal with non-existent problems. Now, sometimes laws survive on the law books long after the problem has disappeared. There are laws in the state of Florida, for example, that forbid you from hitching your horse out in front of a store on Main Street, which I don't think that law has probably been enforced in the last couple hundred years, but anyway, there are laws like that on the books, which are no longer relevant. And once in a while, you'll find some clever prosecutor that'll pull out some archaic law like that. As I read in the paper the other day, prosecuted somebody, they couldn't figure out any way to nail it, and he got this law, old ancient law about cussing in public. The guy had said a couple of cuss words in public, and they nailed him. Find him and whatever, because they dredged out this 18-something or other law. But anyway, so the fact that it says you shall not eat blood, and not just once but 17 times, the law suggests this was a problem. Well, in what context is it a problem?
If people ate blood, they could, unless they didn't have as good preservation of food, could it make them sick really easily?
Okay, so you're looking for a physical purpose.
Well, I think God made rules also for the physical, so they wouldn't get sick.
Sure. You think drinking blood will make you sick?
Well, it
makes me sick just to tell you about it.
No, I'm talking about like eating meat with blood in it. If they didn't eat it soon enough or cook it correctly or whatever, preserve it correctly, would that make them sick?
It's quite possible. is king.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mrs.
Young.
Maybe said it would
make him
desensitized to the value of blood.
I think that's part of it, certainly. Certainly, yes.
The pagan cultures around them utilized virgin blood and other things with their religious practices.
I've read that and I've taught that. I wish I could have it down more concrete evidence. Now, what I do have here with me today, I do have with me an article that I dug out of some scholarly magazine, Biblical Archaeologist on Cuisine in Ancient Mesopotamia, which would be the same region. Now, this does not appear to be like pagan ritual, but yet I noticed, I read through all these ancient recipes. These recipes are anywhere from 3,000 to 6,000 years old. Recipes, believe it or not, for all kinds of things. For example, here are these recipes. Did you know they had, where was it? I had some of these things underlined. I'll read it for you. They had 20 different kinds of cheeses. This is back 3,000 B.C. 300 different kinds of bread, depending on the combination of the grains and so forth. But what I noticed was, that is relevant to our study right now, is that in several of the recipes, it indicated that they used blood as a thickening agent, much like we use what, cornstarch? Yeah. It says, again, they used milk or beer or blood were used for thickening agents. And it'll talk about like marinating the animal in its own blood for a period of time before. I'm not kidding you. And also boiling things in milk. And there's another law a little bit later that's been obscure for all these years. It talks about boiling a kid in its mother's milk. Nobody knew what in the world I was talking about. Kid meaning goat, Mrs. Young. young goat. Young goat. Okay. But I'm trying to just let my... Here's the actual recipe for red stew. It says you do not need meat, prepare the water, throw in fat, pluck tripe and belly and salt, hold malt, onions, in other words, they don't know what it means, cumin, coriander, leeks, in other words, they don't know what it means, crushed together. Before placing on the fire in the pot, the meat should be marinated in the blood which has been saved from the animal butchered for this dish. That's just one example, several in there where I noted they used blood as a marinating agent or as a thickening agent in their cooking. So now, you see, these are tablets that have happened to come to light which document the use of blood in cooking. I don't know, did anybody do any research on blood or anything like that in terms of whether we can document that they actually drank blood in a pagan ritual? I read that and never been able to nail it down. Okay, well, I still haven't nailed it down yet. In any case, blood was not to be eaten, and I think probably Mrs. Young is on the right track when she said God is trying to teach them respect for blood. The life is in the blood, and ultimately it's respect for life. Now, even clean meat from clean animals, was sometimes regarded as unlawful. If it had not been properly butchered, for example, or if they found an animal just had dropped dead in the field, they were not to eat it. Or if they found an animal that had been torn by wild beasts, or they were not allowed to slaughter their animals in the field apart from the tabernacle. Now, this is while they were in the wilderness, and this law would be modified before they reached the land of Canaan. But in Leviticus 17, verse 7, he explains why that is. Somebody flip over Leviticus 17, 7. Why they were not allowed to butcher their animals, any animals, even if it was a clean animal, and properly butcher. They were not to butcher it out in the field. Now, why does it say? What does it say?
They must no longer offer any other sacrifices to the goat idols to whom they prostitute themselves. This is to be a lasting ordinance for them and for the generations to come.
Okay, in that context, you read the context, what's talking about. Apparently, there were these goat demons that were believed to occupy the wilderness or the desert. desert, and they were afraid that if people started sacrificing or even killing their beeves out in the desert, that they might be tempted to render worship to these goat demon creatures that were believed to inhabit the desert. So therefore, all sacrifice, all slaughter of meat, whether for secular or religious purposes, was to be done at the tabernacle, at least during the wandering period. As I say, that was relaxed a little bit when they entered into the land of Canaan, but during the wandering period, that was the case. Now, meat from unclean animals, of course, was always forbidden as well. In fact, we're told it is an abomination to God's people to eat this unclean meat. Now, what were the categories? What made something unclean? Animals which did not chew the cud or have a split hoof were considered unclean. Birds that eat, buzzards that eat dead things. Fish which do not have both scales and fins, that would eliminate catfish. And shellfish would be eliminated from diet under this law as being unclean. And Orthodox Jews today observe these laws very carefully, as do some Christian groups, like Seventh-day Adventists and Jehovah's Witnesses observe these dietary laws. There are some people, some New Testament Christians, that are absolutely convinced that the rationale behind these food laws was primarily physical and for health purposes, and they will not eat these foods either. Now, what are the explanations of these unclean categories? Why were some animals considered unclean? And I've gathered a list of 7 different reasons I've found in various books. Now, they don't all hold to just one of these, but usually some combination of these 7 suggestions. There are those that say that these unclean animals explain these categories in the ethical dimension. Abstinence from blood tames the instinct for violence. This is one of the oldest explanations about why they weren't to eat blood. Aristeus, in the first century B.C., a rather famous Jewish writer, made the comment that if you drink or eat blood, it makes you more violent, it makes you a violent person. Therefore, since God does not want his people to be violent people, he has forbidden the eating of blood. Now, I don't know if anybody's ever documented that eating blood will make a person more violent. I do know when an animal gets a taste of blood, an animal will become much more vicious once they've tasted human blood. They become very dangerous to human beings. Once they've killed a chicken and eaten chicken blood, they go on the rampage. You can't trust them around chickens anymore. Now, I don't know if that has that kind of effect on human beings or not. But at least that was one of the most ancient explanations. You see, people have been wrestling with this question from, look how far back, first century B.C., they've been wrestling with this question, why did God pronounce certain kinds of food to be unclean? Others say it was aesthetic reasons, that these animals that are unclean just were ugly to look at. Others say it was theological reasons, that these animals that were forbidden were favored in the various pagan religions and were actually used in pagan sacrifices. Others say it was hygienic, that these are animals like hog meat, for example, even today is notoriously susceptible to trichinosis and other kinds of diseases, and catfish and these kinds of fish, unless properly cared for, can be very dangerous. And so some would argue that it was hygienic reasons that were the overriding. Others have suggested that we have morphological reasons, that is, that the creatures that are rejected as unclean are creatures which are sort of living between two spheres. They're not clearly fish, and like a fish is supposed to have scales and fins. Here's a catfish, it doesn't have scales. It's not clearly in the category of fish, and therefore it's separate. It's to be eliminated. So that's another explanation. Others have suggested an economic motive, that the animals that are considered unclean were those that would be uneconomical to raise in that region of the world. And still others, and this is a more recent medical suggestion that I came across, that we have here what we might call an ethnic reason. They've now discovered that certain races of people, or ethnic groups if you prefer, are highly susceptible certain kinds of foods. And that God may have eliminated these particular kinds of foods because his people, these Semites, these Jews, would be particularly allergic to this kind of food. So here's another physical explanation. So what is the truth of the matter? I don't know. And God doesn't really say why. He does not bother to explain why certain foods were considered unclean and other foods were considered clean. He just simply says, these are an abomination. You're not to eat these to his people. Now, you recall in the New Testament when the sheet came down from heaven and Peter was told by God to do what? And all manner of four-footed beasts on that sheet, Peter was told to take and eat. And God thus was erasing the distinction, it seems to me, between the clean and the unclean animals at that point, so that the dietary law of the Old Testament is no longer binding upon the conscience of Christian people, as I understand the New Testament teaching at least. Well, note this, I thought this quote from Milgram was very interesting. It says, relative few individual statutes of the Bible are coupled with the demand for holiness, and none of these have the demand with the same staccato emphasis and repetition as do the food prohibitions. So apparently, this was a very important aspect of holiness among the Israelites in the Old Testament period. And God wanted them to every day, three times a day when they ate their meal, to remember that they were special. And there were certain things they did not do, no matter what country they were in or what kind of an environment that might have surrounded them. And why, then, do we have these dietary laws? Well, I think God is trying to teach holiness should extend even to the very mundane things of life, that we are to avoid all appearance of idolatry, if these animals, in fact, were associated with idolatrous practices, that we are to eat as unto the Lord. Eating should be something we dedicate to the Lord as well as anything else that we do. And as Renee suggested a minute ago, we to educate people in respect for the reverence of life. Respecting the blood would be one way of emphasizing that point. I think this is why Jewish people, by and large, even the somewhat liberal Jewish people, are in the forefront of the campaign to of the Right to Life campaign in our society. And they're also to practice holiness not only in what they eat, but in what they dress, in the way they dress. Transvestite dress is an abomination. Deuteronomy 22:5. Somebody flip over to Deuteronomy 22:5. Transvestite dress, I think you'll see what it is if you don't, if you're not familiar with that term when you read the verse.
A woman shall not wear anything that pertains to man, nor shall man put on a woman's garment, for all who do so are an abomination to the Lord.
Okay. We're going to talk a little bit more about that verse later on, but this is basically this abnormality of where men, I guess women too, but men, some seem to like to go dress up like women. It is connected with homosexuality, and yet it's a different kind of a type of a thing. I heard a mother on a telephone talk show last week call in, and she discovered in her son's room, a 13-year-old son, all kinds of women's lingerie and underwear, pajamas, and all kinds of things like that that women normally wear. He was hiding away, apparently dressing up in these, in this garb at night or whatever. I don't know. It was about to break her heart, I know. And so this is what we're talking about here. This is an aberration, and it's an abomination before the Lord. When we come a little bit later to the seventh commandment, we'll develop that a little bit more. Another type of garment that was forbidden was a garment made of mixed materials. Deuteronomy 22:11. Somebody look over in Deuteronomy 22:11.
Do not wear clothes of wool and linen woven together.
All right. Do not wear clothes of linen and wool woven together. What's behind that? Well, apparently, you know, the Canaanite worship was a fertility type worship based a great deal around sexuality, and by mingling different kinds of things that are not found normally together in nature. They believed that magically they could influence the harvest, so they could influence the rainfall and things like that that are essential to a good agricultural economy. And so the scholars think, although we don't know for sure right now, we think that that's the reason behind the prohibition of the mixing of the kinds of garments. Because in paganism, that was one of the main things they tried to do in their temples, was to mix these kinds of things to try to produce a good harvest. Well, okay, the practice of holiness, again, in the area of discrimination. Now, here are some verses that are going to be difficult for us to grasp, I think, but let's turn to Deuteronomy 23, several verses there. Let's just get over to Deuteronomy 23. We'll look at some verses here. Verses 1 and 2 start with, "No one who is emasculated or has his male organ cut off shall enter the assembly of the Lord. No one of illegitimate birth shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of his descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall enter the assembly of the Lord." Now, we need to understand what this is talking about here. What does it mean to enter the assembly of the Lord, the congregation of the Lord? We're not talking here about faith. We're not talking here about worship. We're talking here about citizenship. We're talking about voting rights. We're talking about being a recognized member of the nation. There was, in fact, to be a discrimination. Now look at verse 3, another discrimination. "No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord." And then on down a little bit further, it talks about the Edomites in verses 7 and 8, to the 3rd generation. Now, what in the world is this? I thought we'd already discovered that in the Old Testament, there was an effort to reach out and to share the word with Gentiles. We have Rahab converted, we have Ruth converted, we have the record of many Gentiles converted, and yet here we have specific legislation that is mandating a certain type of discrimination. And so let's make some observations. First of all, we're not talking about a ban on faith. I said that already. The congregation here would represent men of legitimate bloodline. Men of legitimate bloodline. If you are of illegitimate birth, you have no bloodline. You cannot establish your inheritance. You cannot establish your bloodline. That's the thought here, you see. In that kind of culture, every citizen had an inheritance right. If you couldn't establish your bloodline, you had no inheritance. Didn't mean your soul wasn't precious to God. Didn't mean God didn't love you, but it meant for practical purposes, in the everyday world, you could not establish your ancestry and hence had no inheritance. Now, as Rushdoony explains it, he says the purpose of the commandment here is the protection of authority. Authority among God's people is holy. It does require a separateness. It does not belong to every man simply on the ground of his humanity. So God has drawn the lines here among his people of old. And it's interesting. Now, why does he forbid a eunuch, one who is emasculated, to be a part of the assembly? Because the assembly will make decisions that will affect future generations. And you see, if you have no children, your interest in that which affects future generations, theoretically at least, will be less than a person who has children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. As you see your children and your grandchildren come along, you begin to become more interested in that which is going to happen after you're gone. A person who is a eunuch cannot have children, and therefore his interest in those future generations might not be as serious as someone who did have children and grandchildren. At least that's the explanation that I've come across. Other than that, I don't really have much to suggest on these particular laws of discrimination. The main point is that, again, God's people were to be holy, collectively, individually, separate from that which was of the world, that which was unclean, from death, and from paganism. God's people were to be unique and distinct. Well, let's go to lesson number 9 and talk about the name of God. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, or you shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God. It occurs verbatim in the book of Deuteronomy, in the listing there in Deuteronomy 5. There was a time when this particular commandment had a central place in the church and in society. And you know and I know that that is no longer the case. In fact, Howard Rand has a book called The Digest of the Biblical Law, which is a book really designed to argue that we should even live by the law of Moses. But even in that book, this particular law is virtually ignored. It just virtually is ignored by everyone today. In fact, we even read of attempts to try to justify swearing. A book recently by Ashley Montague says, swearing serves clearly definable social as well as personal purposes. In other words, it's a good thing, he says, that we blow off steam and cuss a blue streak or whatever, and use foul language. I think we need to emphasize, as over against Montague, that cursing or swearing is not a universal phenomenon in the world. Montague says, this is natural. Everybody does it. It's done all over in all society. Therefore, why should we try to prevent it? It serves a useful psychological purpose. But it's not true that this kind of talk is universal in its origin. As I understand, I'm not an anthropologist. From my reading, I understand that swearing, at least swearing in the sense of using the name of the deity in a derogatory manner, is not found among the American Indians, or at least not until the white man came and corrupted them. Among the Japanese, or the Malayans, or most Polynesians. Montague cites a few examples among some Aborigine people that he says that he can document swearing, but that really there's a difference between swearing and using filthy speech, as we will see in just a moment. We try to distinguish between these kinds of things. But let's start out by reviewing some information for some of you to be reviewed. Some information about the name of God. And, of course, there are several names in the Hebrew for God. El is perhaps the oldest name for God that we know about. A Semitic name. It means God as most powerful and strong. It's used 243 times in the Old Testament. It's not very frequent in the prose narratives, found mostly in poetry, but also appears as part of some of the oldest names. You see that L on the end of those old names from Genesis? Mahujael, Methusael. That L on the end, you see, is abbreviation for God's name. Another Hebrew word for God, Eloah, is the singular of Elohim, and again, it emphasizes the power of God. That's the kind of power that terrifies, I guess we would say. It's used 57 times, mostly in the book of Job. Far more common is the plural form of Eloah, which is Elohim. And this is God in his omnipotence, the God of creation, the God of the Gentiles. Whenever God is associated with Gentiles in the Old Testament, he uses this particular name. And you can see it's used over 2,400 times in the Old Testament. It's plural. The em ending is plural, but it's always used with a singular verb when it refers to the one true and living God. This is a peculiarity of the Old Testament, and many have puzzled at trying to explain why you have a plural word for God used with a singular verb. You don't have to be a linguistic expert to know that they was is not good English. You have a plural subject and a singular verb. But in Hebrew, every time the name of God occurs, that's exactly what you have. So various ones have tried to explain it in different ways. Delitzsch says this is the plural of intensity, whatever that means. Others have said it's the plural of majesty. Like a king might say, let us do something, and really he means I'm going to do something. Trouble is, you can't document the plural of majesty was ever used in the ancient world. Some say that the plural is used because it includes God and the angels. Another says that it's quantitative plural, that is, meaning God is so great, it's unlimited greatness. But I don't know why people so shy away from the obvious significance that we're talking about the plurality of the Godhead. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, who act collectively as one person. Hence the plural noun and the singular verb. Another Hebrew word that is frequently used of God is Adonai, which means literally my Lord, my master. It's a recognition of God's sovereignty. God is the king. He is the master. We are the servants. It is a recognition that we stand under God's authority and at the same time under his protection, because a master has the obligation to care for his servants. So if we recognize God as our master, it not only means we have an obligation to obey him, but we are recognizing that also he has made a commitment to take care of us as his people, as his servants. Now, sometimes they combine these names of God to form interesting specific names that were used to remember various occasions where God appeared. El Elyon, God Most High, is used frequently by Gentiles, and particularly Melchizedek in the Old Testament. El Shaddai of the Psalm fame means God in his might as he reveals his might to individuals, in the lives of individuals. El Olam, which emphasizes the eternality of God. El Roy, which emphasizes the omniscience of God. El Kana, which emphasizes the jealousy of God that we talked about last week or the week before. But the name par excellence in the Old Testament of God is, of course, the name Yahweh or Jehovah, as it has mispronounced since the Middle Ages. This is God's name as it appears in Hebrew. It's sometimes called the Tetragrammaton, tetra four grammaton letters, the four-letter name of God. And scholars are not really sure how it was pronounced in the ancient world. The best guess, but remember it is only a guess, the best scholarly guess is that it was pronounced something like Yahweh. Yahweh. Put an H in there a little better. Yahweh is the best guess as to how it was pronounced, but we don't really know for sure. It appears to be related to a Hebrew verb, the verb to be. And the basic meaning of the word is he who is, or the eternal one. In fact, there are some versions that translate it every time it occurs as the eternal one. Well, take your break and we'll come back and we'll talk about how this name of God can be misused. We'll talk about dirty speech and all kinds of stuff next hour. It should get interesting.